the revenue generated from the complete interchange will go to pay down the debt of the interchange, the debt assumed by the village and the private entity.
I don't know, given the current statutory limitations on public-private partnerships and any kind of privatization, I don't know that we could do something like that. That we would have to evaluate. But if they were working again with a local unit of government, I think we'd have to look at whatever the individual deal is. There are probably a thousand different ways that something like that could be structured. But if we wouldn't necessarily be precluded outright if we were still working with that local unit of government in some way, shape, or form.
One of the components of the interchange policy is for the local community to submit this whatever the financial plan is early on, so we can evaluate it. So that's one of the things we always look for. How do you think you're going to finance this project?
So nobody's approached to that route, yeah, right?
No. I think the most community led from that perspective would probably be Balmoral, right?
Yep,
where they actually issued the Rosemont issued the bonds, mm-hmm. and that's a little different than some of our others, where they really took a lead on issuing and constructing and doing a lot.
They issued the bonds, they financed the project,
yep.
and our agreement is that a portion of the revenue goes to the village that way. That's the way we structured the agreement. Definitely unique on that one, but it was the opportunity that we had at the point in time of the agency.
For them to take the lead and absorb some risk, frankly.
And the contribution back is right where the cost of the project, the 50-50 split, when we hit that.
So the 50-50 split, they assumed it, they financed it, and a 50-50 split was able to pay the debt down.
We will they will get a portion of the revenues up to up to whatever happens first. I believe it was the first 10 years. I don't remember all the particulars of the agreement. It was at a point in time. That's it. So if the revenues don't come where they thought it would come,
they're absorbing some risk.
They're absorbing the risk on it.
But they're not just getting an unlimited. If it
right.
if it goes gangbusters and takes traffic off every other interchange in the area, they don't necessarily get all the upside.
Well, the tollway assumes the long-term viability of the interchange,
that's
so
right.
that you can't really do that.
And you can't, right, exactly, because and a lot of times what it is at these interchanges, it's a redistribution of traffic. At Balmoral, you just move people from, it attracted new, but then it pulled people from existing interchanges to get off over there because they thought
you back door to the airport.
Most people
don't know that.
They were going front door to the airport right now, right, exactly.
Now people
I figured that out yesterday. Wow, I can get off here.
That's
the airport. It's the best way to go in.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from the south.
Anything else on Elgin O'Hare?
Elgin O'Hare, and the other things that we're doing at legislative tours and briefings, letting legislators know about the project, what's really happening out there, when it's going to be happening, and the different particulars about that project. So that is ongoing. 294-57 interchange. I want to give you some updates on that as well. Again, this is the other project we're putting a lot of time and effort. We've done quarterly mayor's meetings, actually the quarterly elected officials meetings. It's not just the mayor's, any of the elected officials. Last one we had was on November 13th. We've also done several meetings in Posen with some of the property owners in the community to make sure that they understand some of the relocation assistance that we have going on there, unfortunately. Some displacements associated with the project, so we've been doing a lot of intensive work with the residents through there to make sure that they understand how we approach land acquisition, relocations, and displacements. We had one community meeting, I'd say about 40 people attended on November 7th, and what we did there, this was definitely first for us. We had our negotiators and relocation counselor all in attendance. It's more of a one-on-one session, so the people who were being displaced had the opportunity to talk to somebody who was handling their specific parcel, but then also to have more of a closed door one-on-one meeting with a relocation counselor, again to make sure that they understand all of the rights, what happens, how it happens, and when it happens. It was very successful. We actually plan on setting up another meeting similar to this on December 18th, so next Tuesday evening, again with the residents, again educate them on different programs that are available to them, and bringing in some of our partners from the Illinois Housing Development Authority to update them on different programs that are available.
We have developed some new partnerships in this one because it is an unusual situation. As you recall, we have now implemented a policy for negative equity situations for homeowners. I mean, it's something that just the tollway and frankly a lot of others wouldn't have had to deal with,
mm-hmm.
and probably haven't had to deal with in the past, where typically Once somebody moves in and starts paying their mortgage, you know, you expect your home to appreciate in value, and obviously with the financial crisis and real estate crisis, many people's homes are actually worth less than the mortgages that were owed. So we did, you know, enact that new policy and have also now enacted some new partnerships with the with IDA, the Illinois Housing Development Authority for the state, to try to, you know, help facilitate, you know, a greater level of assistance with transitions or getting people into new homes. Because what we were finding there is that, you know, we were paying off, able to pay off mortgages, so people weren't, you know, having to be underwater on the mortgage or on their property when we purchased it. But, you know, the next challenge is how do they get into another home? You know, credit has dried up. You know, the banking industry isn't what it was. Housing finance isn't what it was. So IDA's starting to be very helpful there. And I think we're also going to have, you know, some similar assistance for some of the, there aren't as many, but some business relocations that may have to happen there. So we are trying to do a little extra. I think it is obviously always a matter of working closely with homeowners to try to help them understand our process. I mean, these are individual homeowners. They aren't, you know, professionals, you know, land developers or land holders that have worked through these types of acquisitions many times before, so we want to make sure that they feel that they're getting enough information and being treated fairly in this, as we're certainly trying to do that.
How many homeowners?
It's about 20 single family homes. The numbers are reducing because several of them have been relocated already or well along in the process.
So 20 single family?
It's kind of a mix. Yeah, it's a bit of a mixer there.
What do you do in that situation? I mean, I know we were talking about it, but I don't think I ever heard the final solution. Do you pay the bank off at the value that they mortgaged it, and then just...
Our negative equity policy, that's what was adopted, that allows we pay off the...
What are you using in the new home then?
We do have some relocation assistance funds that by statute we're only allowed to go up to a certain amount. Mm-hmm. We are exploring whether, you know, part of our partnership with IDA will be, you know, working with these individuals and seeing, you know, how many of them, you know, are in a good position to get maybe a new mortgage or have some credit. There are also opportunities for what we would call housing of last resort, which give extra, you know, extra opportunities for assistance to, you know, whatever subset of these 20 homeowners would fall into that category, where, you know, it's clear that there wouldn't be a way to transition them into, you know, a commensurate, similar type of housing situation without, you know, deploying some extra resources, and we're exploring and working on all that. I think the picture will become a little bit more clear in the next couple of months. I know that there's certainly, though, some anxiety at the local level, and we've been trying to meet very consistently and be available, but, you know, I think that, as often happens, you know, this is a very difficult situation to be going through. And, you know, part of the issue is that these homes were constructed so recently.
Yeah.
You know, frankly, after the right-of-way of this project and the path of this project was well-defined publicly, some of these homes were permitted and built. The zoning was actually changed to accommodate this little development right there.
So 20 homeowners, any renters?
Yeah, there are some renters as well. Total is about 60-plus relocatees.
And commercial?
Commercial, there are about 10 commercial businesses.
In some of those, some of that 60, though, are things like billboards, correct?
I was just going to say, some of those
aren't
are billboards.
Aren't necessarily people.
Right, it's moving to billboards.
Corporations are people, that's right.
Billboards are, too.
That's right.
And binders.
Incorporated, they're a person.
It's a little bit easy. No, I shouldn't say, nothing's easy, I know that much. But that's our intent on these community meetings, to make sure that they understand what options are available. We bring in the experts to talk to them about what it is. So we've done one on November 7th, December 18th, next Tuesday. We've got another one set up, making sure that people are getting the right information from us, because as you can imagine, there's a lot of interest from others who provided some misinformation that's out there as well. So we want to make sure they're getting it from us directly. We provide the assistance. We provide real answers. And likely we'll be going back out there again in January, mm-hmm. February, maybe March, continuing until we take care of the situations.
And our context here is the interest in moving the project along fast enough that we don't lose time and money to achieve what we're trying to achieve. At the same time, we're balancing individual homeowners and renters' mm-hmm. personal interests.
Mm-hmm. Our relocation specialist has been, it's nonstop for her right now, so she's really, and has done a great job. I mean, a lot of these are moving forward, and every week we get more.
How many did we start with?
The total body was about the 60 with the billboards and everything, so it's 20 single family homes. There was multi-family residential buildings. Each one of those had different number of units.
No, I'm just trying to get a sense
of where we're at. So I think we're at, of the 20 single family homes, I thought we were close to 12.
We're about
now
12.
That we still need to
12.
So we've accomplished
through.
Eight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Some the other things that are happening too, and the number may change because as we look at the project, some people have issues and concerns and say, you know, you've taken so much, you should just take it all. Mm-hmm. So there's some people who've come back and say,
instead of a partial, just take the whole thing.
So it, you know, the number may just bounce a little bit. That's generally the body of what we're dealing with right now.
Okay, thanks.
Some of the business access points, one is, you know, we're dealing with that as well too. I got this type of business and I can't use my business the way I want to after this. So. But it's moving forward. And again, the legislative briefing is on that project as well. So those are the two big projects that have been taking up a lot of time on the council updates. With that, I'm going to hand it over to John Bennett and Diana to talk a little bit more about the sign generator policy.
Good morning. At your meeting in October, we visited with you and discussed the two new signing initiatives that were being proposed as part of the coming year. And those related to you'll recall, we talked about a Blue Board program for attractions and for lodging only in the system. This graphic shows you where the blue diamonds show you where the signs would be located. It's really a rural-focused program because of sign congestion in the urban areas. You would not be putting these type of signs in the urban areas. But for I-90, where we ran a pilot program for many years, a very successful pilot program for lodging only, we basically are taking our lessons learned from there and applying it to all rural segments of the system. And in addition to lodging, we are adding attractions as well. So it would be two new signing initiatives. We gave you a program in October. We did post it online for public comment based on the committee's concurrence with moving forward. We did receive three comments, and I believe you have those comments in front of you. And they ran the gamut of one person wanting us to expand the program to fuel and food, one person saying that they're concerned about overall signage congestion, and one person acknowledging that maybe the need was there, but we didn't need to have signs of actual businesses.
Just
generic icon signs. Those are pretty common. So, with that information, we are back today and recommending that we move forward with the program, if the committee agrees. The fee structure, since this is a pay-for-service, at a full interchange, a participant, if they approve the method criteria, would be paying a first-year cost of $2,000, and then years 2 through 15, $950. At a partial interchange, and we only have a couple eligible partial interchanges in rural segments of the system, they would basically pay half the cost. So we're trying to be fair about it. And then that on.
My boss.
Sorry about that.
So basically it'd be half the cost. So if you're at a partial interchange, you would be exiting and re-entering back in the opposite direction, the cost would be half. Typically speaking, you would not want to put blue boards at a one-directional interchange in accordance with the federal manual. However, for example, on I-88, we have two partial interchanges, one at Sugar Grove at Route 56, and then we have one at Route 47 on I-88, we would literally take both those partial interchanges and consider them as one interchange. And the reason why the manual recommends caution in not putting signs up there is that you don't want to have someone exit the system to stay in a hotel and get up in the morning and realize they can't get back on the interstate that they're just on. So we'll be very careful in terms of how that works. The attractions program, a little more open-ended in that it gives us an ability to allow people who are located within a reasonable proximity to advertise on our system for local attractions. The specific recommendation we are making to the committee today is to actually place this item on the engineering department's consent agenda for the board meeting tomorrow. And the recommendation is threefold. One, to approve the traffic generator and the policy guide amendment. This board approved the original sign policy in 2009. We literally have put together an amendment adding these two sign elements to that policy. So you'd be approving that. You'd be approving the fee structure we just briefed you on. And you would be formally approving funding this program through the Move Illinois program. Total cost of the programs is going to be in the range of $2.2 million. Assuming that we put full deployment at all interchanges, we will take a conservative approach and deploy signs as we have qualifying participants involved. So we're only looking for $1 million funding in 2013. With that, that is our recommendation and our report.
Any discussion or questions on that? So we'd be looking for a motion then to move this to the full board, and that would be approval of the full board attraction sign program.
Mm-hmm. Second.
So we have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We'll move on to Merle's.
It's the land, just that landscape policy.
And this should be relatively quick, too. So we've got existing landscape policies that are in place right now, but our policies really are our erosion sediment control and landscape design criteria and guidance for removal and replacement trees. The policies that we have right now are really geared for our construction projects. Anytime we implement a project, we take down trees, we replace the trees, we want to make sure that erosion control is taken care of during construction, throughout construction. And we've got the replacement plan that we put in place and developing coordination with the local communities for construction projects. One thing that we've that comes up occasionally, 10-15 times a year or so, we get requests from residential people next to the road, or residences or commercial entities, to remove trees. There's different types of trees and types of vegetation that we get requests to remove. It sometimes it's overhanging vegetation, sometimes it's just basically trim some of the foliage on the trees, or really some aesthetic enhancements. But it's the trees that are on our right of way. We don't have any kind of consistent approach to handle that right now, because all the policies that we have are really about what we do and when we do it, but not really geared for the somebody from the community or one of our neighbors actually requesting tree removal. So what we thought, just again to make sure we're consistent, because this does come up, like I said, 10 to 15 times a year, and we've got maybe different ways to approach it in different areas. We want to make sure it is consistent. So what we've developed in partnership, what we're looking at is come up with this landscape policy. When we do get those requests, what's a fair and equitable way to handle this and make sure that it is going to be consistent with not just what the local person wants, but that community as well. Because sometimes these trees that are being requested to be removed are part of the gateway into a community or to a business park, whatever it might be, and there's changeover in an ownership of a facility, and maybe there's an overall plan with what we want to do. There's sometimes we put in vegetation to screen out or to really block some of the snow from coming across the roadway. So there's want to make sure that there's something clear there. We don't want our vegetation to all of a sudden disappear over the weekend when we're not looking, which has happened before. And it's sometimes because we don't know how to handle these situations and, you know, in the same way. So what we've developed, I'd like to put out there for consideration and public comment and really municipal comments, is a new landscape policy focused on tree removal and trimming. You know, take what we've done, expand to it a little bit more. with the policy that that we've developed, I thought it might be with you, but maybe not. It's really making sure that, again, going back to the local municipality would be the submitting applicant on this as opposed to just a commercial entity or residential entity. At least get some buy-in and support from your local municipality where these trees are, what they'd like to take down. But we don't just want to know what you're going to take down. What we'd like to know is what your replacement plan might be. Give us a landscape plan that's comparable. The replacement vegetation that we'd be looking for would be also comparable and consistent with what we have in our tree removal and replacement policy. So if they take down big, beautiful trees, we would expect something comparable to what we would do. After clearing out invasive vegetation, the buckthorns and the like, great, take it out. We'll partner with you on that. We're not expecting any replacements. So what we'd be looking for is what the removal plan is, also what a replacement and restoration plan would be. And if some of these communities would like to do something at the higher end, say similar to what we have at the Morton Arboretum, we'd be looking at a long-term maintenance plan, entirely possible. What we want to make sure is that maintenance plan is coordinated with our field staff, our maintenance department, our permits engineer, making sure these people have the right insurance. So again, just we want to make sure there's this consistent policy. But these are some of the application requirements we'd be looking for. What's their plan to take out? What's their plan to replace? And if they do want something a little high style, we would be looking for a long-term maintenance plan.
Rocco, do we have sort of guidelines or principles within the replacement plan, like we are more inclined to use native species, we don't want invasive species? Are you going to wave a big fat book at me?
We do have a whole landscape design, guidelines and criteria, the types of trees that we like. It's a manual. Actually, we've got a couple different things. We've got our policy, which is more on the technical side of things. We have some design guidelines and criteria for certain areas. Types of plants that we know work. We've actually, something that happened years back, a partnership with Morton Arboretum, through an agreement, they test and try different types of vegetation next to the roadway. It's obviously a very harsh environment. We want to make sure that what's planted actually could last, so we've got a lot of recommended plants, ground cover type of vegetation.
And in the course of issuing permits, will those criteria be the basis on which we make a decision about whether to grant a permit, or how does that work?
We would look at what the replacement plan is, review what the replacement plan is, the types of materials. It's not just a blanket approval. We want to review what they're looking to trim, what they're looking to remove, where the replacements would take place, what type of vegetation. The policy that we have, like I said, we've got design guidelines that kind of talk about the showy type things and the types of plants. Our design guidelines address that. The policy basically says for every tree that you remove, you need to replace X with it. So yeah, the stuff like that is shared. We do pass that along, but we do let whomever come up with their plans, and we could provide that guidance too. We don't want to be overly pushy on them. If they'd like to see something a little bit more showy, it depends on the maintenance too. Some of these, if you annual type things, if you want to get out there and you're looking for different types of maintenance, these are going to be different opportunities.
So let's assume somebody comes in with a plan that's inconsistent with our expectations, then what happens?
We would let them know this is inconsistent, and ultimately it's going to be us using the issue of an approval or a permit for whatever they want to do. So we're going to have to get to the point where we agree on what that landscape plan is and replacement plan.
We're the final arbiter. They can't go someplace else and say the tollway is keeping me.
They can always go someplace else and complain about the tollway. Yeah. But we are the final decision.
That doesn't happen, though, right?
No. Oh, never. But right, not legally. And, you know, they can pursue a legal.
Because it's our property.
Ultimately, it's a permit that we are going to be granting on our right of way.
How many villages have things like, you know, you see it at the 53 exiting in Schaumburg, the walk in Schaumburg, it's stunning flat stone. Mm-hmm. Do we allow that for some, or we have any
requests? We've got Rockford's got some stuff out there, at Route 20 out there. Morton Arboretum just down the street from here.
Really? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oak Lawn, Hickory Hills, there's a handful, maybe more than a handful.
Probably five or six.
Yeah. Locally.
Is that what Bolingbrook did at the 53 Bolton Road?
Mm-hmm. Same type of thing.
Same thing.
So that's
a long-term agreement, they maintain it?
Mm-hmm.
The most expensive one is probably what Rosemont did with IDOT at the they maintain all that.
Right here, that'd be Interstate 88 at Route 53 by the Morton Arboretum. If you've seen that, then it's that's Morton Arboretum who maintains, Morton Arboretum and Lyle jointly maintain that site by permit and by agreement with us. So some communities get, and that, you know, the reason we did that too is to show people, here, here's an opportunity to kind of make your community special as well. So, and we want to have a consistent policy. Everything that we've done to date is really about what we do during construction to replace trees. This is kind of flipped to the little bit.
Are you doing the same thing with what, like the Oaklawn?
Oaklawn, Hickory Hills.
Hickory Hills.
Mm-hmm. During construction, again, we didn't have a consistent approach. We kind of did it as we went along. Oaklawn and Hickory Hills, it's the, they've got the form lighter patterns on there. Welcome to Oaklawn, welcome to Hickory Hills. So they did some landscaping right around there.
We have some conditions right now where corporate offices for a corporation existed on the total than they've approached us in the past. And they wanted a higher level of maintenance than what we could provide. So we worked out an arrangement with them and an agreement. But we, each one we have to do individually. We've never had guidelines. This will give us some good, consistent guidelines. Plus, this will have them going to the local municipality to make sure that anything that they want to do is consistent with the local municipality, so we don't get caught in the middle.
Let me go back to your comment about the level of maintenance that we normally provide. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get an example of that. In other words, if we put a plant trees, do we go in on occasion and cut out dead limbs? Do we, what is the normal level of maintenance?
We don't have an enormous amount of trees in the right-of-way. Those that have been installed as part of construction, we generally cover them under an extended warranty. But yes, we then do go back and go through and check them. In occasion, sometimes remove those.
So could you give us an example of what a normal level of maintenance is and what you're normally doing?
Normal maintenance of the right-of-way, we will mow the right-of-way typically three times a year. If it's a heavy year, we may have to do more. In areas where there's noise wall and residential properties, we are forever on the phone, and we will try to give that a higher level of maintenance or local interest to a community. But the reality is we simply can't provide weekly mowing, which is what some people want. We're just not equipped to do that. So in those areas, people have asked for permission to mow on the right of way. We don't have a mechanism to allow them to do that unless we enter into an agreement. And since the parameters are so wide ranging over the system, the need exists to have a policy. Some of them are very well meaning, and this will help us deal with those. Some of them want us to cut a tree down because they've got an advertiser who wants to put a billboard up in the back. Those we don't.
Right.
So, you know, we need to have a policy that gives us the ability to the system to deal with.
So we do have some areas where trees.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And we have installed additional trees as part of construction projects over the last 1 or 2 years.
So, have we run into any emerald ash borer issues at all?
Actually, we are out there inspecting our trees for emerald ash borers. I mean, that's kind of an annual inspection. We do that. We do also invasive control. You know, we get a lot of requests for clearing the buckthorn thistle. We get a lot of requests from the farmers, especially.
Yeah, in the agricultural area, right, there are laws that govern what you've been allowed to grow next to agricultural fields. And so we do sometimes select spraying, or we'll do increased mowing in order to reduce noxious weed growth.
We've got University of Illinois and the Illinois Natural History Survey actually checks our system annually for those types of invasives, the emerald ash borer, whatever we tell them we might go out there and look for there.
So basically we're talking about this and requests coming in that the assumption is that someone else would be paying for these types of changes.
They would be paying for the changes, and if they, another option which we've done before again, is the, they come in, they say, well, we want to clear out these trees, and instead of them doing the replacement work, if we can't fit in a new landscape plan in this particular area, we'd be looking for some form of compensation to do our own landscape replacement somewhere else. So that is also something that's, if they can't do something within the area of impact, we look for the compensation part there.
I think one of the more though, as was mentioned before, I think an important part of this is that we're really looking for people not to just approach us directly if they're not a local unit of government, you know, if it's a private company or development, but to work through the local community so that we don't find ourselves in the position of one entity asking us to remove something and the community saying, well, but why are you removing those beautiful, you know, bushes, trees, whatever it is. So
ashes
full of ash borers. Right. So.
So the way, this one is going to maybe go a little bit more atypical, and that's why I thought earlier that it's fine if we maybe push this a little further. Since this is different for us, what we've actually been doing already is pushing this policy out to some of these requesting entities to say, here, try this out. We're going to put it out for public comment. We're going to keep this out for public comment through February 1st, so longer than a typical period. And the reason we want to do that, obviously, with the holidays, too, but I want to go directly to your point, with the municipalities, and have them take a look at this, because you're going to be asking municipalities to kind of intervene in some respects. So we're going to do a little bit more concerted effort of the outreach about this to the councils of mayors and some of the municipalities to see if does it work. And then it may not be a hard implementation date. You may still kind of see what happens throughout the now's the kind of the tree removal time frame, that winter or early spring time frame. So if these requests do come in now, it gives us some opportunity to see what works.
This policy would kind of insist that these requests would be channeled through.
And it could be, you know, that's the way it is right now. It's written that it must come through the local government. Maybe it's just getting some support from your local government. A letter saying, yeah, this went to my, whatever, your zoning and planning committee, saying, yeah, this is consistent. Or something from the community to say, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Because we did have instances where trees were taken down, where the local community said, wait a minute. We like this.
Mm-hmm. Even our earlier discussion, would it make sense to, along with the policy, post some pictures of some of the examples of what municipalities have done?
Yeah,
so that
would be good.
People could see what what's going on.
Sure. We've got some good ones, too.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be part of our outreach, too, as we go to the councils and mayors. That's why I've asked some of my staff to kind of take this out and let them know. So it might be a combination of post and photo, but as we go out there, so here's a little fact sheet or something.
Bring the mayor from the municipality and say how easy it was and wonderful to work with the TOLA.
Sure.
If you can find him.
Sure, we can post some photos. So, with your approval, we'd like to put this, get it out there for some public comment.
Sure.
Have we typically taken a motion on these? No, we just.
So just
it's only after the when the final is done.
Yeah, I think I don't think there's any problem with getting a post in this.
That's actually it.
Yeah, we currently have a request that we would actually like to use this proposed policy to see how it works with the request of funding. It's just local here on 9355. So we'll be able to report that to you how that went.
Will there be in this time, same time period? Will there be an effort by staff to communicate with the local government?
Yeah, I've already told my buddy Anderson, who goes out to the council of the mayor's meeting, and told her that's what I'm going to do: go out there, educate, let people know here's the policy. And I think that fact sheet type thing with the photos might be a good thing. Mm-hmm. But I know some of the councils are pretty much shut down for a little while. Maybe January they pick it back up again. So again, that's what my thought was. Extend the public comment period a little bit longer on this one so we can get out to those municipalities. This is not like the interchange of the noise policy where there's a greater degree of familiarity with it.
Right.
This one's a little bit more unique.
Well, education, but I do think most local governments would be, you know, if they understand what we're getting at, would like to have that authority to be.
At least consultably.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Anything else on that?
That's it.
Okay. Any other items? In terms under the okay, if not, then unfinished business. Any unfinished business? There'll be none. Any new business? Okay. If that's the case, then I think that we could entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Do we have a motion now? I'm sorry.
Yes,
okay. Sorry. So I had a motion in a second to adjourn. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. We then hereby adjourn.